First of all, let me say that I appreciate very much this opportunity and privilege that you've given to me to be with you this year in this lectureship. I commend the elders of the congregation here for getting involved in this good work, not just a lectureship, but also in the development of the West Virginia School of Preaching. I know that it's a big effort. I know it takes a lot of work. I know that Brother Daugherty does an excellent job as he works with that school, and I hope and pray that the work that's being done here will continue, because I know much and lasting good is going to come from it. You know, the lectures, or the lessons, if you will, that we have heard up to this point have just been outstanding. I mean, when I first came in this morning, Brother Abbey started off the morning, and from there it just kept on getting better and better. And this afternoon, Brother Roger Rush started, and I thought, boy, I got to follow that. I mean, that's really tough. You might say that when you listen to me, compared to them, what you've heard so far are silver-tongued orators. And I mean no disrespect by that. These men are good, very good. But I kind of feel like those old three milk cows were standing out in the field one day, those old Holsteins. And they looked up, and there went by a milk truck. And on the side of that milk truck, it said, homogenized, pasteurized, fortified. And one cow looked at the others and said, I feel so inadequate. Well, that's kind of the way I feel as I look at some of the others that have stood here today and look at others who will stand here throughout the rest of the week. I kind of feel inadequate compared to them. But I'll tell you what, I'm going to give it my best shot. I'll give it my best shot, and we'll see what we can do. By the way, I can really sympathize with the young men who are in the school of preaching here, myself being a product of the school of preaching. I know what they're going through. And I know how much a lectureship like this meant to me when I was in school. I heard a story one time about some young men that had went into a school of preaching. And, of course, you hear the same instructors day in and day out, hour after hour after hour. And all of a sudden, a lectureship comes up, and you begin to think, oh, boy, I get to hear somebody new. I get to hear something fresh, something different. And, boy, you look forward to it. And these young men got in there bright and early the first morning of the lectureship. And they got up and announced the first speaker, and lo and behold, it was one of their instructors. And one of the young men says, oh, no, out loud. And the lady that was sat next to him looked at him and gave him a funny look. And he thought he had better explain, so he told her, he said, ma'am, he said, I'm sorry, but I'm a student here at the School of Preaching. And that man that they just introduced, well, he's one of my instructors, and I hear him day in and day out. As a matter of fact, we have a nickname for him. We call him Dr. Dahl. And she looked at him, and she said, young man, do you know who I am? And he said, no, I don't know. She said, I'm married to that man up there. I guess that makes me Mrs. Dahl. And the young man looked at her. She said, well, do you know who I am? And she said, no, I don't. He said, praise the Lord. You got to be careful what you say, young man. By the way, Terry and some of the others, I've been talking to some of these young men. I have learned some of the nicknames they've got for you. And some they've got for you, Brother Daugherty. And for a small fee, I will give them to you. My assigned duty with the topic that I've been given is the idea of humanism, concerning man's wisdom versus God's wisdom. And really, since we're going to be dealing with humanism, as we deal with the various aspects of it, we will be dealing with the idea of man's wisdom versus God's wisdom. So the first thing I think we really need to do in this study is simply define the terms. What is humanism? Oftentimes we will hear the term secular humanism used today. Just exactly what is humanism? Then the second question that we're going to be dealing with, we're going to be dealing with three main questions, by the way, in this lesson. But the second question we will deal with was, what is its origin? Where did this idea or philosophy of life, humanism, where did it come from? How did it originate? And then the third question that we will deal with in this hour is, what are the consequences? What are some of the consequences of secular humanism? Well, what is humanism? I simply went back and tried to look at several different definitions that might give you a good idea, an overall idea of what the humanistic philosophy of life is all about and what it is. And I got these definitions from various sources. Some from gospel preachers, some from those who would call themselves humanists, some who are leaders in the humanistic movement, even today. Listen to some of these definitions. The first one I got is from the Gospel Advocate, January 22nd, 1981 edition, from Brother J.D. Thomas, an article that he had there. He said, humanism is the name of a current rationalistic, philosophical, theological movement that denies the supernatural in favor of man himself being the ultimate or highest thing of significance in our universe. The second one comes from a gentleman by the name of Julian Huxley, who is a world-famous evolutionary biologist and who is an avowed humanist. And as he looked at the humanist movement himself, this is what he believes it is. He said, I use the word humanist to mean someone who believes that humans are just as much a natural phenomenon as an animal or a plant, that our bodies, minds, and souls were not supernaturally created, but are products of evolution, and that we are not under the control or guidance of any supernatural being or beings, but have to rely on ourselves and our own powers. Francis Hill, also an avowed humanist, put it this way. The central humanist value is the individual person achieving fulfillment in life through freedom of choice and gratification of human desires in the absence of moral codes. And then this one comes from Brother Wayne Jackson. He said, humanism is a philosophy which suggests that man must look to human experience for moral and spiritual guidance without believing there is a supernatural God or divine power to support or to guide him. And the last definition that we will look at comes from Brother Darrell Conley. And I believe this was in the Spiritual Sword. He said, humanism is a philosophical and religious view, as well as an organized movement which rejects all forms of supernaturalism, including belief in God and his revelation, the Bible. Humanists believe that man creates his own morality and values. Humanism is the deification of man. Man becomes God because there is no God. Now, it may surprise you in that last definition, Brother Conley says that humanism is not just a philosophical idea. It's not just a philosophy that men have. It is also a religious view. As a matter of fact, humanism is a religion, and our government recognizes it as a religion. There is a census that is published by the United States government called the Census of Religious Bodies. And in that book, you will find listed the ethical culture movement, which is one of the mastheads, so to speak, of the humanist movement within this nation. And they have been given tax-exempt status by the Internal Revenue Service and are recognized as a religious body or religious group. And even though humanism has been declared to be a religion, it is still being taught in our public schools. But if we would try to walk through the doors of our public schools to teach about Jesus Christ, we would be blocked because we'd be told, no, we must keep religion and the state separate. We must keep religion out of our schools. And that the humanistic philosophy of life is being taught day in and day out in our school systems, even though it has been declared by our government to be a religious group. As a matter of fact, the United States Supreme Court held up that very idea in a case that came before them, the United States versus Seeger. And the United States Supreme Court held that a humanistic and ethical belief that is sincerely professed as a religion shall be entitled to recognition as a religion under the Selective Service Law. So even the Supreme Court of our nation understands that it is truly a religious view. When you get right down to it, humanism is nothing more than atheism American style. It's the American version of atheism. It is that philosophy of life which wants to do away with God so that man will become his own God, that man will be in control of his own destiny, or at least so they think. In humanism, God is dethroned and man is deified. And the Bible? Well, the Bible is simply relegated to an antiquated book. Oh, they'll say it has some nice stories in it. And you can read in the Bible and you can find some even nice principles or good principles of life that may help you as you live your life here upon this earth. But when you begin to deal with man's real problem, sin, they'll say, well, what in the world is that? And when you say what man needs truly is salvation, they'll say, what do you mean it's needed? Salvation from what? They say that's nothing more than a relic of the superstitious past. That really has no place in a modern society today. The biblical account of creation, as we read it in God's Word, by some kind of supernatural being, well, that's not just rejected, it's not just denied, it's not just vilified, it's actually made fun of by those who hold the humanistic view of life. And man, this lowly animal that they say somehow reached down into the muck and the mire and pulled himself up by his own bootstraps, so to speak, they say that even man has absolutely no purpose or no destiny beyond this life. That this life is all there is. That's all there is. Brother Robert Taylor Jr. wrote an article concerning humanism, and in it, he wrote these words. He said, "Our generation is fond of two little words, in and out. In is the accepted, the desired, the going thing. Out is the rejected, the despised, that which cannot be tolerated by modern man. In humanism, God is out, man is in. Creation is out, evolution is in. Absolute morality is out, situation ethics and fickle moral standards are in. The Bible is out. The humanist manifestos, number one and number two, which we'll deal with later, are in." You know, it's truly sad that man, lowly man, somehow has come to the conclusion that he and he alone has the wisdom, that he and he alone has the knowledge, that he has the ability to chart his own course in life, to determine his own destiny, with no need of any help or guidance from any supernatural being or from anyone that we would call God, because they really don't believe there is such a thing as a God. And you know, when man finds himself in that state of mind, he has totally rejected every warning that the Scriptures have given to man concerning his trying to place himself on an equality with God or putting himself above God. Jeremiah said in Jeremiah the 10th chapter in verse 23, he said, "O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walketh to direct his own steps." Jeremiah understood that. He knew that it was not within man inherently to be able to direct himself in the right path, to do the right thing, to be the right kind of person. That God would have to show him the way. That God would have to show him how. And then in Proverbs 14th chapter in verse 12, Solomon said, "There is a way that seemeth right unto man, but the end thereof are the ways of death." Yeah, man may believe that he has knowledge, that he has the wisdom to direct his own steps, but it's not going to lead him to God. It will not lead him to a life filled with goodness. It will not lead him to eternal life that is to come. It will simply lead to death. Man wants to believe that he is sovereign. In the humanistic view of life, man wants to believe that he is on the very top rung, that he is the center of all things. And yet we know that that is not the case. The Scriptures clearly teach us that it is God. He is the one who is sovereign. God is the one who is above all. One of the most beautiful passages in the Bible that really depict the sovereign nature of God is found over in the book of 1 Chronicles, the 29th chapter. In verses 11 and 12, the writer tells us this: "Thine, O Lord, is the greatness and power and the glory and the victory and the majesty. For all that is in the heaven and in the earth is thine. Thine is the kingdom, O Lord, and thou art exalted as head above all. Both riches and honor came of thee, and thou reignest over all. And in thy hand is power and might, and in thy hand is to make great and to give strength unto all." Doesn't that beautifully show us the sovereign nature of God? The God of creation, the God who made man, the God who is over man, the God who has protected man and given to man everything that man needs to walk in this life, that it might lead him to that life which is to come. And listen to the words of the Apostle Paul in the book of Romans, the 11th chapter, beginning in verse 33. He said, "Oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out." And he continues in verse 36. He said, "For of him and through him and to him are all things, to whom be glory forever. Amen." And yet men will not want to accept this. Men do not want to believe this. But you know, when it comes to man's attitude towards God, we must accept the attitude of the Scriptures. And that's summed up in Romans, the 3rd chapter and verse 4, where the whole attitude of the Scriptures is simply this: let God be true and every man a liar. But let's consider the second question now. What is the origin of humanism? Where in the world did this philosophy of man being in equality with or superior to God, those that would even believe that there was a God, or man trying to surpass God, where did it come from? Since within the very definition itself, we find in humanism the desire of man to be independent of God, then really humanism began clear back in the Garden of Eden. That's where you would have to go. When you go back to the book of Genesis, the 3rd chapter, and in verse 5, here you find Satan telling the lie to Eve. He says, "For God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as God, knowing good and evil." Now Eve heard that. She desired that. She believed that. Therefore she acted upon that. And she ate of the forbidden fruit. In her actions, we find the very root, the very heart of what the humanistic philosophy of life is all about. And that is sinful pride and an arrogant heart. That's at the very root of this humanistic philosophy of life. It is because of this arrogant pride that man desires to elevate himself above God and to reject God. Now, as you begin to study further on, you're going to find out as an organized movement now, humanism really began around 500 B.C. among the Grecian philosophers known as the Sophists. And among these philosophers, there was one in particular by the name of Protagoras, who lived from 485 to 415 B.C. And in his many teachings, we find really there are two main ideas that he presented that are really the pillars of the humanistic movement and how it became really organized among men. The first standard that he taught was simply this. He said, no authority resides external to man. There is no authority outside of man himself. And the second fundamental teaching of his was simply this. He said, there is no such thing as a standard which contains objective truth. There is no standard that we can really use in all cases, at all times, to determine what is really right and what is really wrong. Now, notice what that does. When he says there is absolutely no authority external of man, that does away with God. And when he says there is no standard of objective truth, that does away with God's Word. And what does that allow man to do? To place himself upon the throne. To call himself his own God. To believe that he is the superior one. That he is over all. It's no wonder that the Apostle Paul, as he was speaking to the Greeks at Corinth, spoke these words in 1 Corinthians, the 1st chapter. He said, where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For seeing that in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom knew not God, it was God's good pleasure through the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. And he continues in verse 25, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Humanism, from that point in time, around 500 B.C., has enjoyed what we might call varying degrees of success. It has found its way now into the 20th century. And it's really been within this last century that two humanistic documents have been published. They are called the Humanist Manifestos No. 1, which was published in 1933, and the Humanist Manifesto No. 2, which was published in 1973. And these two documents set out very clearly just exactly what the humanistic belief is, the humanistic philosophy of life. And they pull no punches in these documents at all. When you read these documents, you will know what is at the center, what is at the very heart of this thing called secular humanism. Now, I put in my manuscript, those that may be reading along in the book, that I have reproduced them and they would be a part of this manuscript. And that was not done. And the simple reason was because I forgot to send it. So that's my fault. That's not theirs. But I'll tell you what I've done. I made 100 copies of the Humanist Manifesto No. 1 and No. 2, consisting of 4 pages. And there were 100 copies available on that back table. You simply pick one up as you leave, and then you'll be able to study them for yourself. But I would like to go ahead and read just a few selected things from these documents so that you might know from the humanist's own words just exactly what they believe about certain areas of life. For example, the Humanist Manifesto number 1. It says, religious humanists regard the universe as self-existing and not created. Right away, they blow their horn in favor of what? Evolution. God didn't create anything. What we see is simply by chance, random chance. It's an accident, that's all it is. And man has just been able to pull himself up above all of the other things that through nature have evolved. Second, they say that humanism believes that man is a part of nature and that he has emerged as a result of continuous process, the evolutionary process. Then they say, humanism asserts that the nature of the universe depicted by modern science makes unacceptable any supernatural or cosmic guarantees of human values. In other words, the human has no more value than what any animal or plant or any other living creature might have. We have no value above them whatsoever. And then it goes on. They say religious humanism considers the complete realization of human personality to be the end of man's life and seeks its development and fulfillment in the here and now. They're saying this life is all there is. There is no life that is to come. Man is not a dual being. He does not consist of a body and a spirit. That when the body dies, the spirit will continue to live. But that's not the case. We live here upon this earth. When we die, that's it. It's over with. It's over with. And this is what they say about religion of the past. Though we consider the religious forms and ideas of our fathers no longer adequate, the quest for the good life is still the central task for mankind. Well, they look back on their fathers' religions. Those that believed in God and accepted the fact that there was a creator of all things, and that man truly was made in the image of God. And they say, we have to reject that. Really, man's only purpose in life is simply to fulfill his own desires, to gratify his own desires, to seek the good life, to have a good time, and do what's best for himself. One other thing I want to read. They say, we believe, however, that traditional, dogmatic, or authoritarian religions that place revelation, God, ritual, or creed above human needs and experience do a disservice to the human species. They say that when we teach that there is a God in heaven who created, they say that when we teach that God has left His Word that we might know His mind and that we might know His will for our life, they say we don't help men, we do them a disservice. That's harmful to mankind. It's harmful. And then just as was read in one of the other lessons today, quoting from the Humanist Manifesto, they say, no deity will save us. We must save ourselves. We must save ourselves. When you get right down to it, humanism is simply the worship and deification of man and the total demise of God. That's what humanism is all about. That's what it's all about. But we've got to get to our final question. What are some of the consequences of secular humanism? Well, there are a lot of consequences. And I don't have time to go through all the various consequences that we are seeing right now in our own society, which can be directly linked to this philosophy of life that we call secular humanism. But I do want us to look at three in particular, three that I'm sure that we're all very familiar with in one way or another. The first one, the first consequence, is simply moral relativism. Now, when I say moral relativism, I am simply saying that they believe that there are no absolute statements that a person can make because there's no absolute standard of authority. In other words, a humanist will say this. I say, you can't say that adultery or fornication or homosexuality is always wrong because sometimes it may be right. And they'll say, you can't say that murder is always wrong because sometimes under certain circumstances, in certain situations, it may be all right. It may be all right. Now, in case you haven't already guessed, and probably most of you already have, this idea of moral relativism is a close kin to situation ethics. In other words, whatever man determines in his own mind, in his own heart, concerning his own circumstances in life, that makes law. That makes it right, if we believe it to be right. The secular humanist believes that there is no absolute standard of authority when it comes to moral or ethical conduct in a person's life. As a matter of fact, their belief is summed up in a poem, and if I knew who to give credit for this poem, I'd give it, but I don't know who wrote it. But boy, it really tells the story. Listen to it. It all depends on where you are. It all depends on what you are. It all depends on what you feel. It all depends on how you feel. It all depends on how you're raised. It all depends on what is praised. What is right today is wrong tomorrow. Joy in France and England sorrow. It all depends on point of view. Australia or Timbuktu. In Rome, do as the Romans do. If tastes just happen to agree, then you have morality. But where there are conflicting trends, well, it all depends. It all depends. In other words, if in the humanist mind, if I were to get together here with Brother Emmanuel and say, listen, I believe that child pornography is right, that we can go ahead and distribute it and be right and not do anything wrong. And Emmanuel says, well, I agree with you. Well, then that's moral. Then it's all right. We have determined within ourselves that that is what we believe to be right, and therefore that makes it right. And no one has the right to tell us that we're wrong. That's the way the humanist believes. That's the way they rationalize things in their own minds. That becomes the predominant view when a person believes there is no absolute standard of authority. However, God's will for human behavior is not a matter of subjective speculation. Where God has left it to every man to try to figure out for himself what is right and what is wrong, what is moral and what is immoral, what is ethical and what is unethical. Now, since morality and since really ethical conduct is grounded in the unchanging nature of God, that's how we can know for sure what is right and what is wrong. In Malachi, the 3rd chapter, in verse 6, it says, for I am the Lord, I change not. I change not. When God has declared something to be wrong, it will always be wrong. It will never be right. It will never be right. And I don't care how many people get together and in their own minds and their own hearts come to the conclusion that now, during this century, during our times, during our society, that it's right. If God has declared it to be wrong, it's always wrong. It's always wrong. And then in 1 Peter 1, it should be verse 25. I know in the manuscript it says verse 15. Then in verse 25, it says, but the word of the Lord endureth forever. God's word will always stand. That standard of authority that is given to mankind, it was good when it was given. It was good all through time. And as long as God allows this world to stand, it will continue to be good. It will continue to be right. It will continue to be the guide that we need to follow in life. God has spoken His mind, and He has made His mind known to man through objective biblical revelation. Now, secular humanists will argue that there are no moral absolutes until you begin to infringe on their territory. In my study, I read of something that occurred in 1984. Many of you maybe watched the Today Show on TV in the mornings. Bryant Gumbel is one of the hosts of that show. And on that show, back in July of 1984, Bryant Gumbel interviewed Hugh Hefner. Now, Hugh Hefner is the owner of Playboy International, publisher of Playboy Magazine, a pornographic magazine. And on the show during that interview, this is what was taking place. Hugh Hefner was very upset because a rival publication, another pornographic magazine, Penthouse, had published some nude photos of a woman by the name of Vanessa Williams, who just weeks before had been selected as Miss America. And he was upset because he said those photos were never intended to be published. They weren't taken for that purpose. And in that interview, he made the statement. He said that Penthouse magazine was morally wrong to publish those photographs of Vanessa Williams. Morally wrong. Here is a man who for years has cried out in his publication and on television and on radio and in many other ways that there are no moral absolutes. that there are no moral standards which should guide all men at all times. And yet now, because Penthouse is selling well and Playboy is not selling well at all of a sudden somebody else is morally wrong. Morally wrong. If that's not the pot calling the kettle black, I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. You see, when you get right down to it, everybody, even Hugh Hefner, has moral absolutes, whether they want to admit it or not. But you see, the difference between a Hugh Hefner, a humanist, and a Christian is that we know where those standards come from. Those standards come from God. Our standard of what is right and what is wrong is rooted in the goodness and the authority of God, our Creator. We therefore know where our standards are. The humanist has no idea where his standards come from. It's only if they're hurt. If somebody has hurt them, then they feel now that their standard has been violated. And that person is wrong. That person is wrong. The second consequence of secular humanism is the lack of regard or respect for human life. Humanists, they will say, when you read their booklets and all their pamphlets and the other things that are published, they will say that they truly seek the dignity of man. But they don't know how to go about it at all. They really don't. We know that man is made in the image of God. We know that. But B.F. Skinner, a noted secular humanist, wrote, he said, "No, not like God, more like a dog." Now, isn't that some kind of view to have of mankind? We're not like a god, we're more like a dog, just like any other animal that exists. In a book entitled The Great Evangelical Disaster, Francis Schaeffer discussed this very low view of man. Listen to what is said. He said, when one accepts the secular humanist view that the final reality is only material and energy shaped by chance, then human life is lowered to the level of animal existence. Then there are only two classifications, non-life and life. If one thinks of human life as basically no different from animal life, why not treat people the same way? And so it first becomes easy to kill children in the womb. And then, if one does not like the way they turn out, to kill children after they are born. And he goes on to say, after all, according to the secular humanist, human life is not intrinsically different from animal life, so why should it be treated differently? Really, abortion, the abortion issue, is a good example of the logical consequences of secular humanism. As a matter of fact, it's promoted in the Humanist Manifesto number 2. They believe that every woman has the right to abortion if she so desires. That ought to be a right that is given to all without question. Without question. Now, if you go through and say, well, I'm going to discount passages like Genesis, the first chapter, where we are told that we are made in God's image, or I'm going to discount passages like the 136th Psalm, where David recalled how God had seen him even as a person and as an individual while he was in his mother's womb. Even if you discount those passages, then you are left with simply determining the right or the wrongness of abortion judged upon its expediency. Is it expedient? Since 1973, when the United States Supreme Court handed down their decision on Roe versus Wade, it has been expedient in this nation. My material says over 15 million times. That's the best I can come with. Earlier today, I believe it was Brother Abbey, in his lecture that he mentioned, it was better than 30 million times, I believe. Just think of that. 15 to 30 million times in our country. Just 2 years ago, in the Journal of Pediatric Medicine, a doctor wrote these words. His name's Peter Singer. He said, only the fact, and he was talking about, now let me set the stage. In the article, he was talking about how, because of our modern technology, we are now able to detect if a child will have some kind of physical flaw or mental disability. And we can make the choice very early in the pregnancy that that child has a problem, and then we can go ahead and go through the abortion process very early in the pregnancy. Now notice what he wrote concerning that. He said, only the fact that the defective infant is a member of this species, Homo sapiens, leads it to be treated differently from the dog or the pig. Species membership alone, however, is not morally relevant. Just think of that. He considers an unborn child
an infant, before it ever comes out of the womb, from the time of conception all the way time to where it is ready to be given birth and given life, to be nothing different than a blob of tissue like a pig or a dog. That's all. That's all. And this is a man in our medical profession. In our medical profession. And I'm glad to say that not all physicians are like this. As a matter of fact, I had the privilege of going down to Marshall University and hearing my youngest brother take the physician's oath. And in that oath, he swore that he would protect life, that he would do whatever was necessary to see that life was maintained. You see, that's the oath that the doctors take. And yet, because of these humanistic views that have been creeping into our society all down through the years, we find that even our physicians are turning away from the oath that they had taken in the very beginning. Abortion, infanticide, and euthanasia are but dominoes in a line. And abortion, we've already seen it fall. And brethren, I'm not sure that we can ever do away with the devastating effects of abortion on our nation. I hope and pray that it's possible. I'm not sure that it can be. But I want to tell you something. Infanticide is tottering. It's on the edge. That's if a child has some kind of physical defect or mental defect that the child then can be killed after birth. And then euthanasia, that is simply a term meaning mercy death, easy death, mercy killing. We are seeing that taking place in our nation also. We have all been reading over these last several months the things concerning Dr. Kevorkian. I hate to use the word doctor in relation to his name, Mr. Kevorkian, who he believes that it's right to go ahead and help people and assist them in taking their own life. We're seeing that in our nation. And as hundreds and thousands of lives are being prematurely snuffed out each year, we see that in our society today that the value of God-given life is dirt cheap. It's really been cheap. Men have placed themselves in the very place of God. Men have said, we have, with our own ability and our own mind, the wisdom and the knowledge to determine who has the right to live and who should be put to death. That's a scary situation. It truly is. And the third consequence of humanism is the elevation of man over God. Secular humanism exalts human reason as supreme. It is the placing of man at the center of all things, making him the measure of all things. In secular humanism, man himself becomes God. In the very opening of the Humanist Manifesto number 2, we find these words. As in 1933... humanists still believe that traditional theism, especially faith and a prayer-hearing God, assumed to love and care for persons, to hear and understand their prayers, and to be able to do something about them, is an unproved and outmoded faith. Now, by talking about traditional theism, they are talking about those who would believe in God, those who would place their faith and their trust in God as a creator of all things. And they are saying that this kind of belief is unproved and outmoded. So what does that do? That very quickly allows a humanist to get rid of God and to place himself upon the throne. That's all you have to do is to get rid of God. However, we find that the infallible and the majestic Word of God tells a much different story of what we should believe. In Isaiah, the 55th chapter, verses 8 and 9, we find the prophet declaring this great truth about God. He said, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts. Robert Taylor Jr. put it this way, and he put it in very, very clear terms. We cannot misunderstand. He said, Jehovah, not puny, weak, finite, sin-filled, and soon-to-die man, is the high, holy, and lofty one, who majestically and marvelously inhabits eternity. And then he goes on to say, little man pales into deep inferiority and utter insignificance when he seeks to exalt himself above God or in the place of God. Why in the world would man want to try to get rid of God? Because he wants to live his life with no strings attached. He doesn't want anyone to be over him. He does not want to recognize anyone or any being as having authority over him in anything. And it's not that man cannot know God. When you get right down to it, it's that man does not want to know God. Because to know God is to recognize God and to recognize that there is a power or authority over Him. And they do not want to do that. And for those that want to deceive themselves into believing this, into thinking that they can do that, that they can simply do away with God and enthrone themselves, the Apostle Paul reminds them of what takes place. In 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, it says, "And with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this cause God shall send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie." If a man wants to believe in his heart bad enough that God does not exist, God will send strong delusions that will strengthen him in that belief. If that's what he really wants, that's what he really wants. If he wants to do away with God, then God will send delusions that they will call proof and evidence to do away with God. That's what this idea of evolution is all about. The problem of man is not that he doesn't know what to do. The problem with man is that he knows what he ought to do and he doesn't want to do it. He knows that it's wrong and he does it anyway. That's the problem with man. And the attitude of many today is a very perfect mirror reflection of the attitude that was found among the days of the prophet Micah. In Judges, the 17th chapter, and verse 6, it says, "But every man did that which was right in his own eyes." That's at the very heart of the humanistic philosophy of life. Every man doing what is right in his own eyes, in his own mind. Every man doing what he wants to do. Brethren, we have seen some of the destructive nature of secular humanism in our society. We see it in the consequences that we've just talked about. In the cheapening of human life. In man wanting to do away with God and not recognize the power and the authority of God over him. But I do not believe for a moment that we have seen the full force of secular humanism. Because as it continues to grow in our nation in popularity, as it is continued to be embraced by people, then I believe with all of my heart that when it comes to moral and ethical things in our society, it's going to continue to get worse and worse. And I don't believe we've seen the end of it yet. We need to be careful. We are finding that even though we live in a society where morality and right and unrighteousness, I should say righteousness, not unrighteousness. We live in a society where righteousness is being ridiculed. We need to remember the warning from God. In Isaiah, the 5th chapter, in verse 20, God pronounces a judgment upon those who call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness. And that's what we're seeing in our society today. That's what secular humanism is built upon, of calling that which is good and right and holy, God, His authority, His power, His creation, they are calling it wrong, evil, that which doesn't even exist. They are putting light for darkness and darkness for light. We need to remember, the psalmist said,